Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Checking me out. So, do both of you know who was Lord Kapila? You know who is Krishna. Kapila is an avatar or expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the source of everything. So he expands himself. The example of Brahma Samhita is a candle or a lamp that then lights so many other lamps, and each of the other lamps get the same illumination, same heat, same light, same power, but one is the original lamp. So it's like that. Kapila Deva is an expansion of Krishna. And he appeared very, very, very early, just like three generations within into the first of the four yugas, Satya Yuga. Four yugas? Satya, Treta, Dwarpa, Kali. We're in this one, Kali. The beginning is Satya Yuga, duration of life is much longer. So, in each of the four yugas, there's a yuga avatar. One who descends to give the yuga dharma, primary means for spiritual perfection. Kapila Deva is such an avatar. He established the method of achieving perfection for Satya Yuga. It's not that before he appeared, people didn't know anything. In fact, his father, in his lila of appearing, his father was Kardama Muni, and Kardama Muni was already not only practicing meditation, dhyayate, is that process of satyuga meditation. He had achieved spiritual perfection through meditation, fixing his mind on the personality of Godhead. Lord Vishnu appeared before Kardamuni, his father, saying, "I know your desire is to have me as your son, I'll become your son," and so many other things. So, Kapila Deva was the son of Kardamuni, teaching the means of achieving perfection in Satya Yuga. And when reading in spiritual texts about Kapila Deva, almost always what one hears about Kapila Deva is he taught Sankhya philosophy. Sankhya means an analytical study of categories of matter and categories of spirit. Like in Bhagavad Gita, in the first instruction Krishna gives, matter and spirit, we're not this body, that's Sankhya. And he says so. At the end of that section, he says, "I've now explained Sankhya." So Kapila also explains Sankhya, but, you know, graduate level, undergraduate Bhagavad Gita, graduate level Bhagavatam, very expansive. Close the door. Let everyone get settled here. Thank you. So there's a connection between meditation, Sankhya, and Bhakti. So here's the connection. The goal of both meditation that Kapila taught and the Sankhya that Kapila taught, the goal of both is the same. It's unmixed devotional service. Not different than the present age, just the means to get to that is different. And so in the previous chapters, just like a little review, Devahuti is asking Kapila Dev, her son, how do I overcome my excessive attachment to the bodily conception of life? I'm suffering, my mind is disturbed. I know the philosophy. I know I'm not this body. I know I'm spirit soul, but I have so much attachment to the bodily conception. And it's troubling. So please tell me how I can get relief from this. And Kapila Dev then instructs her that the means to overcome that is devotional service, bhakti. And whole chapter 25. We're going to be discussing 29, so this is just who is Kapila and lead us up to where we are. How does devotional service begin? Through association with sadhu. So there's a whole sadhu sangha section. Who is a sadhu? How do you identify a sadhu? How do you associate with a sadhu? What's the fruit of association with sadhu? Devotional service. And then, the next chapter, 26, he discusses sankhya in detail, the goal of which is devotional service. But details and details and details, details and details about the relationship between, the unfolding of creation through subtle to the grosser forms of matter, and the cause and effect of material creation. And at the end of the chapter, he summarizes very quickly, the purpose of all of this is to identify that we belong to the category of spirit, not matter, and that the spirit should become fixed in meditation upon the super soul, the supreme spirit. That's Sankhya. And then the next chapter, 27, he says, here's how you do it. Here's how you live your life when you're doing, following these teachings. And the goal is unmixed emotions. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says these two chapters, 26, 27, it's bhakti mixed with sankhya. The next chapter is bhakti mixed with meditation or ashtanga yoga. Because when you have the proper analysis of matter and spirit, then the instruction is to fix your mind upon the super soul. So how do you do that? Your intellect is properly discriminating. Now, the mind. How do you fix the mind? So he describes the meditation process, ashtanga yoga, in detail. Not so much detail. He itemizes the eight. It says, this is how you do this, this is how you do that, and then step by step, the mind becoming absorbed in the Supreme. And then he describes what's that like. It has details of the form of the Supreme that the yogi performing that meditation fixes his mind upon. And so there's features of the body or the spiritual form of super soul, and then the smile of the super soul, and then the laughter of the super soul becomes really personal. And when one experiences that happiness and laughter of the super soul, one's in ecstasy. And in that state of ecstasy, there's detachment from all external temporal things. Then he goes backwards and says, if that's not there, here's what one experiences. Conditioned life. There's lots of, so many nice things David, in that section. David Hoogee says, wait. How does the psychic part I get, like, you know, that was with my original question, I'm paraphrasing. I know the philosophy. But the soul is so inextricably involved in matter that even you can feel some detachment because you know your spirit, soul, not matter. But they're so involved. The influence of matter and the previous identification with matter, although now I think I'm a spirit, after some period of detachment, there's attachment again. So, is it possible? And Kapila Dev says, yes, it's possible. Because the bhakti has its own power. Knowledge has its power, bhakti has its power. The power of bhakti is it can dissolve the false ego. It can dissolve the mind, material mind. And then this absorption that doesn't revert back to the previous contamination or material condition. So the solution is not just meditation, the solution is bhakti. So one needs to come to unmixed bhakti position. Even inside yoga, although, so we say the process, just repeating a theme here, but the process of sattva yoga is meditation. For meditation upon what? And in that state of attaining perfection, what is it? It's devotion that's pure, unmixed. One still lives one's life, you don't just 24/7 you're in meditation. You do things. And how do you do things? How do you do things? So how do you do things in such a way, how you live your life in Sadhya Yuga, that you're achieving spiritual perfection? So it's described, but the most important is the principle. And Prabhupada explains, too difficult to do the Sadhya Yuga process in Kali Yuga. The same principle is involved in chanting of the holy name and devotional service as Lord Chaitanya did, but here's how you do that one, and here's how, you know, one corresponds with the other. This is easy and direct. The other is beyond the capacity to do. So that's 28. Now we're discussing 29. So, in the beginning of 29, I'm just going to be discussing, starting with verse 6. So the first five verses, Devahuti says, since bhakti is the fruit of this Sankhya, any philosophical system, the goal is not just knowledge, the goal is devotion. So could you describe devotional service? Although he's already described devotional service in chapter 25. This is 29, so he wants to hear it again. And then she asks some other questions. The whole format of Bhagavatam is questions and answers. In this case, Devahuti is asking the questions. And Kapila Dev is giving answers. So she asks, in addition, about devotional service. She asks about eternal time. Fantastic topic. Please describe eternal time, which is a representation of your form. And by whose influence people in general engage in the performance of pious activities. So time and time's influence upon the soul. And she also wants to hear about adverse fruitive activities, people that don't have this consciousness of bhakti, what happens, what's the consequence. And the explanation is, it's an impetus for engaging in bhakti, because I know if I don't, there's consequences. The consequences are so undesirable. It leads to detachment. Why don't I engage in fruitive activities? Well, the experience is unpleasant, the consequence is unpleasant, consciousness is covered, my real happiness is lost. So that's an option I don't want. A path I don't want to go down. It leads to detachment from fruitive activities. She's asking like that. And so Kapila Dave is very happy hearing the questions. And then he starts explaining devotional service that has it's influenced by the modes of nature. And bhakti, this is very important, bhakti is pure. Just like, you know, air is pure and water is pure. But air can be contaminated and water can be contaminated. But water, the element, is pure. Air is pure. On a spiritual platform, even more so, bhakti is pure. But the individual soul may be influenced by the modes of nature. And when they engage in devotional service, according to the various modes of nature, it's identified as mixed bhakti. So where he's going with this is, what is unmixed bhakti? And a very important dimension of these lower modes, or modes mixed with bhakti, is a sense of separateness, separate interest. In the mode of ignorance, a particular kind, mode of passion, a particular kind, even mode of goodness, a particular kind, but separate interest. So the oneness of bhakti is oneness of interest. Entirely. Otherwise, there's a mix of interests. I'm interested in the Lord's interest because it'll fulfill some interest that I have, which isn't the Lord's interest. It's very nicely described. And then, so the conclusion of that little section is, what is unmixed bhakti? Because her question was, please describe devotional service that is the outcome of this Sankhya and meditation process. Some mixed bhakti. But it may go through phases before it gets to be the unmixed bhakti. And here's what unmixed bhakti is. It's very similar. Just like expanding the principle that Rupa Goswami teaches in Nectar Devotion, that bhakti is without mix. It's without the mix of fruitive activities or mental speculation. So he's just taking that principle and expanding the principle. Or say it the other way, Rupa Goswami, from study of Bhagavatam, has taken the essence in a distilled little tight verse. Cover verse 15 and 16. And let's read what 14 says. By attaining the highest platform of devotional service, that's not where he started, but that's where she's asked what it is. It's our next devotion. One can overcome the influence of the three modes of eternal nature and be situated in the transcendental stage, as is the Lord. It's very significant when the modes of material nature don't act anymore. Besides, it's a big sigh of relief. The modes of material nature activate material nature. And the modes of material nature then activating Prakriti manifest the material mind, material intelligence, and pervasive is the false ego. So if the modes of nature subside, then the material mind dissolves. And material intelligence that being driven by seeking happiness through fruitive activities sorted out by our material intelligence how to do it, it's over. Yay! Bhakti has that potency. As long as there's a separate interest, then the modes of nature are acting even within the realm of bhakti. So the mind is hard for the mind to be steady and absorbed. The modes of nature. So the potency to dissolve that whole program is bhakti itself. And that the last is that the object, this works this way because the object of devotion is beyond the modes of nature. So you absorb yourself, this is yoga, absorb yourself in linking with the Supreme, you're lifted beyond the modes of nature because he's beyond the modes of nature. And the actions and disturbances of material existence subside because the modes of nature have subsided. It's almost like say it in reverse. If you want to disturb life, stay within the modes of nature. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to disturb life, become situated in devotion to the Supreme. If you want Vaikuntha, then that's Vaikuntha. Okay, so text 15. A devotee must execute his prescribed duties, which are glorious, without material profit. Without excessive violence, one should regularly perform one's devotional activities. Purport. One has to execute his prescribed duties according to his social position as Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. The prescribed duties of the four classes of men in human society are also described in Bhagavad Gita. The activities of Brahmanas are to control the senses and to become simple, clean, learned devotees. Kshatriyas have the spirit for ruling, and they are not afraid on the battlefield, and they are charitable. The Vaishyas, or the mercantile class of men, trade in commodities, protect cows, and develop agricultural produce. The Shudras, or laborer class, serve the higher classes because they themselves are not very intelligent. Paragraph. From every position, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, sva karmana tam avyarjya, one can serve the Supreme Lord by performing one's prescribed duty. It is not that only the Brahmanas can serve the Supreme Lord and not the Shudras. Anyone can serve the Supreme Lord by performing his prescribed duties under the direction of a spiritual master or representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. No one should think that his prescribed duties are inferior. A Brahmana can serve the Lord by using his intelligence, Kshatriya by using military arts. Arjuna was a warrior. He had no time to study Vedanta or highly intellectual books. The damsels of Vrajadham were girls born in the Vaishya class, and they engaged in protecting cows and producing agriculture. Krishna's foster father, Nanda Maharaj, and his associates were all Vaishyas. They were not at all educated, but they could serve Krishna by loving him and offering everything to him. Similarly, there are many instances in which Chandalas, or those that are lower than Shudras, that served Krishna. Also, the sage Vidura was considered a Shudra because his mother happened to be a Shudra. There are no distinctions, for it is declared by the Lord in Bhagavad Gita that anyone engaged specifically in devotional service is elevated to the transcendental position without a doubt. Everyone's prescribed duty is glorious if it is performed in devotional service of the Lord without desire for profit. Such loving service must be performed without reason, without impediment, and spontaneously. Krishna is lovable, and one has to serve him in whatever capacity one can. That is pure devotional service. Paragraph. Another significant phrase in this verse is nati himshena, meaning with minimum violence, or sacrifice of life. Even if a devotee has to commit violence, it should not be done beyond what is necessary. Sometimes the question is put before us. You ask us to not eat meat, but you're eating vegetables. Do you think that is not violence? The answer is that eating vegetables is violence. And vegetarians are also committing violence against other living entities because vegetables also have life. Non-devotees are killing cows, goats, and so many other animals for eating purposes, and a devotee with a vegetarian is also killing. But here, significantly, it is stated that every living entity has to live by killing another entity. That is a law of nature, jivo jivasya jivanam. One living entity is a life for another living entity. But for a human being, that violence should be committed only as much as necessary. Two short paragraphs. Done. A human being is not to eat anything which is not offered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, yajna shishtanana santaha. One becomes freed from all sinful reactions by eating foodstuffs which are offered to Yajna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A devotee therefore eats only prasad, or foodstuffs offered to the Supreme Lord. And Krishna says that when a devotee offers him foodstuffs from the vegetable kingdom with devotion, he eats that. A devotee is to offer to Krishna foodstuff prepared from vegetables. If the Supreme Lord wants foodstuff prepared from animal food, the devotee should offer this, but he does not order to do that. Last paragraph, we have to commit violence. That's the law of nature. We should not, however, commit violence extravagantly, but only as much as ordered by the Lord. Arjuna, engaged in the art of killing. And although killing is, of course, violence, he killed the enemy simply on Krishna's order. In the same way, if we commit violence as it is necessary by the order of the Lord, that is called nati himsa. We cannot avoid violence, for we are put into a conditional life in which we have to commit violence but we should not commit more violence than necessary or than ordered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's a touchy subject.
Mm-hmm. I've never heard this.
Very. No, it's not a politically correct position that Prabhupada is taking. That is to say, you know, in name only, at least. Can something be done about that?
We should
go to some other room. I mean, if the child can be quiet, that's fine, but that's distracting. Buddhism, or the principle of ahimsa, whether people call themselves a Buddhist or not, is popular. It's notional, but not, you know, it's not factual how people live. You know, as one could make a short list or a medium list or a long list of things that just by breathing, just by drinking water, just by walking, just by eating, or try stopping any of those things so that you're nonviolent. Don't breathe, don't eat, don't drink, don't walk. And as soon as you do any of those things, other living entities are suffering. So, minimize. How do you, so, just a recent experience was at Washington University in St. Louis. The topic led to Bhagavad Gita. It was really nice. I got some feedback from Jamuna Jivana afterwards. Two students said, I should start studying Bhagavad Gita. It's a really important book. But one of the students raised the standard question. How can this holy book advocate war? War means killing. I thought, spiritual teaching says don't hurt other people. Anyway, there's certainly an answer. The way that Prabhupada has answered this is super fantastic. One of the things I said to the student, when I was starting to read Bhagavad Gita, it was during the counterculture days of the 60s, where, love and peace and flowers and anti-war and then that's the context in which Prabhupada was presenting Bhagavad Gita. So naturally there was lots of questions about the topic. So the message, very simply, the message of Bhagavad Gita is not a message of non-violence. Rather, the message of Bhagavad Gita is, and here, the message of two things, only as much as necessary, and under the codes of Dharma, and not otherwise. Just like so many things. Prabhupada's statement that we don't say no sex, we say no illicit sex, because there are demands of the body, like eating. So we don't say don't eat, because with the eating process, there's violence. So don't eat. But only take Krishna prasadam, and take Krishna prasadam is certain vegetables, as he's saying here, where the violence is minimal or minimized comparative to other, and then take only Krishna prasadam. Act under the codes of religion as your standard of your life. And the codes of religion are given by God. We had this really nice discussion the other morning, Sunday morning, from Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Lila, that's describing Lord Chaitanya's position as Krishna. The Bhagavan feature of the Supreme Lord encompasses Paramatma and Brahman feature of the Supreme Lord. And then the means of realizing that is devotion, just like this section. Devotion, and devotion means just like this section. There are duties according to our nature. So the idea is not to deny our nature, become natureless. And just put everybody in a blender and turn it on high speeds and we're all the same. No, we're different. The modes of nature are there. And they're to be regulated under the codes of Dharma. But so this whole discussion, what if you don't have, in Prabhupada's purports, it was describing the Buddhists that say that the goal of life is nothingness, voidism. So how do you, so what's the standard of nonviolence, for example? What's the meaning of nonviolence if the goal is nothingness? Because where everything comes from is nothing. Where everything is going to is nothing. So what's the nonviolence principle? The nonviolence to nothingness. So the standard, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, similar to what's here about the principle of violence. Without one's clear understanding, fixed consciousness upon the absolute reality, any idea of morality, like nonviolence or regulated violence or whatever it is, that's not in conjunction with the absolute reality, absolute truth, there's no question of morality. There's no question of ethics. It's just the mind. And the mind changes, and in one period of time, this is ethical, and then another period of time, that same thing is not ethical, or something that was unethical now becomes ethical. It's just the movements of the mind. There's no real standard. And then you get people with different opinions. And because they have different opinions and they think their opinion is right, they start fighting with each other. Then you have violence. So the word... Nati him shrena, without ati him shrena, na ati him shrena, excessive violence. And then another very important term in the Sanskrit, animitena. It's so nimitta. Nimitta is an important Sanskrit term. Has different applications. But it's in Bhagavad Gita where Arjuna is being told, become the instrument of Krishna. Nimitta. Become Krishna's instrument. So nimitta is the instrument of something. The instrumental cause in technical terms. So animitena is where you do something, but it's not you're doing something to get something. You're not the instrument of your own desire. You know, your actions don't become carried out to fulfill something. It's really fascinating. Really, it's a fascinating. Who does something without wanting to get something? It's desire. So what's the state of desirelessness? It's not impersonal. It's the instrument to get something for Krishna. It's exactly this point of violence. We offer foods to Krishna, and Krishna eats them. And we take the remnants of the offerings to Krishna. And that's the means of sustaining our life. We become the instruments of Krishna, fulfilling Krishna's will. And when you live your life that way, that's a desire. And it's a liberating desire. It's how bhakti dissolves the material mind. How bhakti dissolves the modes of nature. The impetus is not the modes of nature. The impetus is Krishna's will. Now we're all, so back to the earlier discussion, we're all influenced by the modes of nature. So what's important? We regulate those modes of nature activities according to the codes of Dharma. We have a social structure for that. This, you know, it's a big discussion that hasn't happened yet. Of how to implement Varnashram Dharma within ISKCON. There's some devotees that are really strong advocates of it. Shivaram Marsh, I don't know if you are familiar with who he is, he's the GBC in Hungary for this wonderful project, Echo Village, New Brajadam. Sustainable agriculture and living their life according in their community according to Varnashram. And how to do that is major. So he wants to he's a strong leader, a strong personality and a strong leader. He was born in the West, I think in Canada. And he became a devotee there and served for a while in Canada and the US and then went to Hungary, went to the UK, served in the UK. Now he's Hungarian. His parents are Hungarian. So, you know, he speaks Hungarian. He's leading the Hungary devotees in sustainable agriculture, you'll think, something that Prabhupada wanted. They're doing it. And now the whole Varnashram thing. In our GBC meetings, we plan to set aside a substantial amount of time, not just like problem solving kinds of things, but in envisioning how to practically carry forward for future generations things like Varnashram within ISKCON, because it's not clear, although it's been discussed, you know, for a few decades, at least three. It's in here. It is. We're within the modes of nature. We're instructed to go beyond the modes of nature. But you can't just okay. Now I'm beyond the modes of nature. What's next? There must be a social structure in which one is pursuing pure devotional service. I'm not there yet. I see that's the goal. Now how do I live my life? That's our social... See, his point, it's a nice point. He said, we're not just a religion. We're a spiritual organization. And a spiritual organization has a social structure. It's a major thing that makes a difference between ISKCON as a worldwide spiritual organization and yet another religion. They got this belief system and these rituals and, you know, these teachings, and so does everybody else. It's just a nice point. There's a social structure. It's part of the revolutionary perspective. Now, how do you do it? not easy to understand how to do it. So we'll, anyway, it's a nice, it's a wonderful, challenging kind of dialogue and then implementing. It's very much related to this whole thing because Kshatriyas have to protect. When the student at the WashU asked their question, you know, I thought you spiritual people are supposed to be nonviolent. A short reply I gave was, supposing you're walking along the street and you see a real big guy beating up on a little guy or a kid. You're going to be nonviolent, right? So what are you going to do? So you call the police. Okay. Now what are the police going to do? Be nonviolent? They're going to do something. Because that's their duty. It's their nature, and it's their duty. So there has to be some element, some section of society that extends protection, and that protection as is needed, not, you know, in the news these days is police that are going way beyond their, you know, call of as required and being really violent. So that's not okay. Anyway, she said, okay, I get it. This is, again, the context of the discussion is Devahuti is asking, can you please describe devotional service? It's the fruit of any philosophical system, including yours, the Sankhya system. What is it? And it's a means to get to unmixed, unalloyed devotion. And then there may be some mix. But we have to properly regard the Binadrik is the one of the terms that's used. Separate mentality, separatist mentality. A devotee with a separatist mentality. I'm interested in Krishna's interest, and the reason I am is because it'll help me fulfill my interest. I mean, that's pretty a blunt or gross statement of the situation, but to whatever degree that's there, it's not. Not yet pure devotion. So now this is this verse, just say it again, I'll read it again. The execution of a life of devotion. We have our duties. A devotee must execute his prescribed duties, which are glorious, without material profit, animitena, without excessive violence. Nati him shrena. One should regularly perform one's devotional activities. So, I think we'll just end with that, text 15. Discussion?
That kind of mixed devotion or selfish devotion.
Mm-hmm.
In any way, is it worse than no devotion?
Is there any way that's worse? Well, we don't want to make offenses while we're mixed. But even with that, you know, even if someone is, by being in contact with the Supreme Pure, one becomes pure. There may be some reaction for offense, but that's better than no contact with the Supreme Pure. Your question. You have something in mind in particular?
So if we do it wrong, does it set us back?
If you do it wrong, then what?
Does it set us back, like the offenses
No.
we talked about?
temporarily some reaction will come, but the spiritual benefit remains even during that reaction experience, because Krishna has accepted devotion that's been offered. That's one's eternal credit. You know, flip your question around the other way. Should we avoid rendering devotional service until we're pure? Because until we're pure, there might be some reaction for some mistakes made in devotional service or offense made in devotional service. Until we're pure, then we shouldn't even start devotional service. That's a contradiction, because devotional service is a means to become pure. So in the course of becoming pure, we'll make mistakes or make offenses. We shouldn't be cavalier about it and say, oh, so we're going to make mistakes, no problem. Okay. We don't deliberately make mistakes, but there may be mistakes. And there's eradication of those reactions for those offenses or mistakes simply by chanting. Yes.
Guru Maharaj, I have a two-part question. So, regarding this Varnashrama Dharma, knowing one's duty, prescribed duty. Mm-hmm. So, my first question is, this is a common question that we hear, you know, how do you even know what is your duty? Because all of us today have certain jobs that we perform. But it's probably far from the kind of duty, prescribed duty that's being talked about. My second part of the question is, going back to your point about this effort to bring in Varnashram system within ISKCON, trying to understand what are the real hurdles, because this is not a totally new concept, because it's been around for hundreds and thousands of years earlier. So what are the hurdles that as a society or the leaders are facing in implementing it?
We'll do the second one first, because it's fresh. And many. Categories of those hurdles. Does it meet some person's hold of view? Sure, Varnashram should be implemented, but it's not for devotees. It's for those who are not devotees, including Gaudiya Varnashram, because it's the safety net for those who don't perform devotional service. Devotional service carries them beyond the modes, you know. Therefore, they hold that view. It's not for ISKCON, it's for, you know, it's part of our program for outreach and engaging those people in Varnashram. And yes, we may set an example just to instruct, but it's not for us. It's just for the instruction purposes. Another is, it's not practical for this age, you know. We take to the Yuga Dharma process. Another, you know, related to that, the Varnashram system is so much dependent upon qualified brahmanas, where there's qualified brahmanas that can give the proper Brahminical guidance to society so that the Varnashram system will work. Again, it's, you know, therefore we have. You know, another is, Prabhupada didn't make a big emphasis. Yes, he said 50% being, you know, how many, what was that the theme of what Prabhupada taught? So it's just like there's roadblocks. And, you know, then it's meant for rural life. You know, people who have farms.
So the debate is not just how to implement it.
Oh, it's all...
the need for it.
But it's the how-to also. It's, you know, some people it's why, and then some people it's how-to. You know, how do you do it? You know, it's so then on the how-to is... Are you going to say... So... We should we go around with this designation? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a Brahminical GBC. And you're a Kshatriya GBC. Or something like that. Well, how do we... I heard... What, you know who Vedasar is? You don't know Vedasar. He's a temple president in Atlanta. He was in the... He was from Nepal. Mm. And he became part of the Guru Kula that Bhakti Vidyapurna Swami conducted. And, you know, this is like, how do we understand? This is your first question. How do we understand? He just, okay, you're a Brahmana, so all you do is for Brahmana things. Your brother, he's a Shudra, he just does Shudra things. You know, we organize our school according to Varnashram. And, you know, Vedasar has a dislike, because he's just like, as a little kid, all he did was, you know, learn mantras and do yajnas and Brahminical stuff, and it kind of burned his natural desire for those things in a wholesome way. And then his brother is Vaishya. He's like, he's really good at making money, but he was put in this, Shudra role. So how do you do it? And then another is, that we're also mixed. We're Kali Yuga eyes to the mask. We got a little bit of everything. Salt and pepper and chance, all in one package. Well, what are we? How do you identify what your duty is? And so it's the implementation. Not so clear. Not so clear.
The major case for need for Varnashrama is it because devotees have had this tendency to neglect their psychophysical nature and go,
There's different perspectives on need. That's something that Prabhupada said. You know, the solution to that one what Prabhupada said was, because my disciples are negligent in their japa, their sadhana, they're the hearing and chanting activity, they're not chanting their Gayatri mantras, they're becoming fallen. Mm. Because of neglect of the uplifting feature of the transcendental dimension, there's need for Varnashram. That was one of his arguments. It's not just neglect of psychophysical nature, it's just that as far as need. So we need to reinstate Varnashram because people are neglecting their psychophysical nature. Not so much that's being perceived as need, maybe that's yet another dimension. But it's something that the main driver is something that Prabhupada said he wanted. It's like in his books all over the place. Mm. But it's important, and we don't have clarity on what it is and how to do it. So we should spend time. That's the need. And then, like as Shivaram Rao says, I don't know about everybody else. But I can say I'm not beyond the modes of nature, so what am I supposed to do? Should be regulated by Varnashram. Submit myself to Varnashram. And what and our whole society. It'll help us become qualified for unalloyed devotional service. No, so there's another emphasis, just hearing and chanting will qualify you for unalloyed devotional service. Just do it. you know, and focus our attention on that. Why get distracted? That's the transcendental process. That's the Bhagavad Dharma message. So don't distract us, please. Something else? Yes?
Maharaj, so with regard to the bhakti with intent or with the benefit, so if it's to become pure, is that also kind of a selfish intent?
It can become a prideful motivator. I don't have any material desires. It's not selfish. It's love. The interest of the beloved is my interest. And, well, can you say that's selfish? Well, you know, that's your interest. The interest of the beloved.
But the extension of that question, originally when I joined ISKCON, the only aim was, okay, I'm suffering a lot in this material nature, so I want to get rid of it and be with God. So is that also something like a personal interest?
Yes.
It's not
yes. At the same time, I recall reading Back to God Ed article, Prabhupada was explaining in the beginning, that's good. You take that away, and people will leave.
But is it a desirable? Or
yeah, good? No. It, in the beginning, it's good.
Okay.
With the understanding that in course of time, that impetus will subside.
Yeah.
And then what are you going to put in its place? You should be pure devotional service. Yeah.
Mm.
Wanting to go back to Godhead and be with Krishna and no more birth again in this mature world. In the beginning, that's good. And stages that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu teaches is Mama Janmani Janani Shwari Bhavatad Bhakti Rahai Tuki Twahi. That's very important. Let me be engaged in that kind of devotional service, birth after birth, even liberation. Not going to Krishna, just being in service to Krishna. Okay?
And this is on the topic of violence. I was in a panel discussion where there were some other spiritual advisors coming from different
traditions.
And so the whole scene was that there were a pool of students, they were going to write questions and pass them to the panelists. So there was one question from one student directed towards this Jewish rabbi. And so the question was very straightforward, like, what is kosher? And he went on to give, the rabbi went on to give a very elaborate description of what is a kosher, like picking each and every animal and trying to, it's just so disgusting to hear, like how he was explaining. And then he ended his whole remark with like a quiz, like naming an animal, what do you think is a kosher or not? So when I was hearing the two points that you mentioned, that only as much as necessary and according to codes of religion, so according to their codes of religion, so cow falls under the description that he was giving. So I was just wondering, like, how do we handle in a more like an interfaith setting, like, although we, from our standpoint, we are clearly evaluating this is gross sin, and from their standpoint, they are following the codes of religion. So how do we actually? I was so disgusted by his explanation, I was not even able to follow what he was saying.
It's really difficult. This is something that I've learned, you know, in the hard way recently, is political correctness in interfaith or speaking about another's faith. If you speak something, you can have very strong conviction in your own, but a no-no is making some judgmental kind of statement or derogatory kind of statement about another's faith. That's, you're in a box and you're spanked if you do that in a public forum. It's politically not correct. So how to speak up in a public forum, an interfaith forum, I don't have experience with that. So I can't so much say. You know, just have your own convictions and live by your convictions, and people ask you, why don't you do this and why do you do that? You can give your answer, these are my convictions. Just be an example of the teachings, and don't cross the line of being politically incorrect, because then you get spanked. And then people will deride, oh, look at this person. He's not politically correct. Now, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu certainly did something different with Shankazi. So what kind of scripture is this? You kill your mother. But interfaith is much more hand holding. Kumbaya. I would imagine, you know, in course of doing that for some time, you can perhaps have a sense of somebody that's more open to consider. And then have a private discussion with them. I don't know the territory so well. Anything else? Yes.
Related to that, a while ago, I'm sure all of you have seen it too, but I saw a video of Prabhupada having a conversation
That's different. That's not in a public setting in a gathering. It's Prabhupada as an acharya speaking to a cardinal. And he did it by, you know, the question answer format. Why does it say that in the Bible? Animals have no soul? Where does it say that in the Bible? They didn't answer the question. He just went on and said something else. Basically, you know, essentially the soul means there's rational faculty. Humans have rational faculty and animals don't have rational faculty. That doesn't mean animals don't have a soul. It just has they have a different body with different equipment.
Organization and not just a religion. And as an organization, like we have culture of our own, which is like new compared to the the culture that's been there. Like I'm talking about external, culture. So when it comes to like adults, devotees practicing, we don't so much need those culture. We would be fine with just the hearing and chanting process. But when it comes to children, for them you need the cultural aspects so for them to get interested and get to know more. So my question is, we as a movement is still new and our culture is still new. and there's not so much, you know, that we can give children in a home setting, you know. So how would it be okay if we, you know, take, bring some of the cultural aspects that we have been raised in, like, you know, we have been, you know, we grew up, like, you know, back in India, but it's, so. So, like, basically the question is, like, you know, how do we, you know, incorporate the cultural aspect, you know, which is, because I find it challenging, like, just for, as an example, like, you know, maybe celebrate in Mashtami, like, the ISKCON way, and, like, you know, how we do, like, you know, it's very different. So, like, if you're in a home for a Janmashtami, for example, if you're not going to temple, the child is not, like, seeing anything other than the parents fasting and, you know, not... but, like, there are so many things culturally that we do it, you know, like, the way we were raised. So I was just wondering how, like, why we try to maintain the principles, how a spiritual organization, this religious culture can be incorporated.
It's like at least three things at once within your question. One of those three things is how you and, you know, within your family or your extended, you know, social group worships Janmashtami is going to be different than somebody else and somebody else and somebody else from some other part of India with another social group. And there's a support structure because of that social group, and that what maintains it over generations. It's just it's something like what Krishna says when he asks his father about the Indra Yajna. Is this something enjoined in the scriptures, or is this a family tradition? Mm-hmm. It's not to say family tradition means it goes into the trash bin. It's just, you know, that which is enjoined in scripture must be done, and that which is family tradition, it's in another category. It may very well be done for preserving culture. But then, you know, somebody from another part of India has another culture, and, you know, and then we're an international society for Krishna consciousness. It's not just people that are... We accept, so that leads into the next thought, we're accepting our disciplic succession, you know, just like our songs. Our songs are Bengali songs. That doesn't mean we can't sing anything other than Bengali songs or we're bad. But that's the primary. And it's nice to appreciate other expressions of devotion. I'm introducing purposely some of that in our festival of the Holy Name. Hare Krishna. From songs from Alvars that are glorifying the Holy Name. And etc., etc. Wait. I'm just like letting things settle down. Going out over time, we want fidelity to our disciplic succession while at the same time respecting differences. So respecting differences. So it's not just, you know, the cultural way in which you, in growing up, observed Janmashtami or did whatever it is that, you know, life is made up of. We'll have another discussion another time. You wanted to add something. Who wanted? You had wanted to add something.
So, in continuation with the Mata discussion. So, when you said it's okay to, let's say for example, a song that maybe before we joined ISKCON we have sung, but taking that song over here and, you know, still continuing with that. My personal opinion is we would have sung with a different conscious, and the moment we sing the same song now, I feel we get the same consciousness that we were singing before, which is not that pure. So is it still okay to sing those songs and the way that we have continued our traditions in the past?
Yeah, this is going way off of, you know, the topic of the morning's verse. You know, it's prescribed duties, and according to Varna and Ashram. Now a short answer to your question is, for somebody the answer would be yes, it's fine. Somebody else is best if you don't do that just now, depending upon the consciousness of and the transcendental position of an individual. Our strength in the Hare Krishna movement or followers of disciplic succession is to follow disciplic succession. That's our strength. But even in our disciplic succession, respect, Bhaktisiddhanta taught respect of other traditions, the other sampradayas, and then went to great length to try to teach, you know, that sense of mutual respect. But, you know, more important, like, I mean, certainly important is, you know, the sense of purity with which we do things. But one can even chant, you know, or sing songs within one's own tradition and be absorbed in something other than the spirit of that song. You know, like, you know, the musical performance. Well, so we stay in fidelity with our tradition, and we respect other traditions. Now, your question about worshiping or doing things in a way that with which we were grown up. I mean, it could be quite confusing what to speak of. You know, to others in ISKCON, it could be quite confusing to your son, because he sees in the home we do this and over there and everybody else is doing that. Could be confusing, you know, like somebody that's brought up in a Christian tradition. Okay, now I'm chanting Hare Krishna, I'm following Krishna consciousness. Should we bring in hymns of praise to the Lord? Because, you know, it's also devotional. I would think certain elements, but the primarily, let's just say how we observe Diwali. All over India, it's a wonderful festival. They observe Diwali in wonderful ways. We're following we respect that. And even if you come from one of those, we follow within ISKCON. Now, your question specifically is, what about what you do in your home? And, you know, I just off the top, without a lot of deep thought on it, would say, you know, something modest, so that there's some sense of your child and what my mother and father's experience was like, and then you know, here's the ISKCON way, or the followers of Prabhupada way, and here's what mom and dad did. So there's some appreciation and some connection with that. But the primary observance is as followers of Prabhupada, how he gave it to us. Because the elements are there. And the faith nourishing those elements is there. And the cultural dimension to appreciate the family connection of my mother and father is fine, but in a modest degree, in a discriminating way, it would, again, without a lot of thought in it. Okay, thank you. Thank you.